Sí.
Chief Justice Phillips is recused. In the next case, he will not participate in the deliberations. We're ready to proceed. And Valerie Devenport versus the Honorable Carolyn Garcia.
May it please the court, we're also going to be represented by Ms. Valerie Davenport and Mr. Samuel Perfone. Ms. Davenport will proceed first.
May it please the court. My name is Valerie Davenport, and I'm the relator in this case against the Honorable Carolyn Garcia. As the marshal has told you, I am aware that an attorney who represents himself in court may have a fool for a client. So I have elicited and been graciously blessed with the aid of Mr. Samuel Buffone, who will address the constitutional issues of the gag order, as well as the question of 76A, and whether or not there's been a violation of 76A in this case. I will address the issue of the removal of the ad litem. Almost 2 years ago, I was appointed by the Honorable Alice Trevathan to serve in the role of guardian ad litem for 213 minor children. It was a duty that the state of Texas and the court recognized as one that is not lightly to be assumed. In fact, as Peters versus Allen said, it is a duty so delicate that no attorney should accept it unless they are willing and shall give to it, in the interest of the minor, the very best of his skill and ability, as if he was obligated to do so by oath.
Your burden is to establish that Judge Garcia abused her discretion, is not?
Yes, it is.
And the adults settled their claim in 1987, did they not? And all that remained was, and that is for the future medical expense up through age 18.
Yes.
And so what remained of the cases upon which you claim that there was a conflict between the adults and the minors?
One of the things that is important in this is whether or not the test for removal is the same as the test for appointment.
Well, if you'd answer my question first, though, what was the conflict between the interests of the next friends and the minors since the adults' claims have been settled?
In Gibson versus Blanton, the Court of Appeals held that simply because an adult non-suits their claim and dismisses any action for medical bills or other personal recovery does not automatically eliminate the conflict between the minor and the next friend. In that case, the next friend settled and non-suited their claim and attempted to have themselves serve as next friend to the minor child. The court instead appointed an ad litem and held that simply because there was a settlement did not in and of itself eliminate or dissolve the conflict.
So it was no abuse of discretion in that case to appoint an ad litem, but here it's the other side of the coin. You're asserting it was an abuse of discretion to dismiss the ad litem.
Right. And what I'm saying is there were many cases in this case, Your Honor. There was a conflict about the medical monitoring program. The fact that these parents had been paid money in settlement to compensate for the extensive medical monitoring of their children until their 18th birthday, that was part of their settlement, or should have been part of their settlement. The fact that money from the minors' settlement was being allocated for the same damages that had been paid to the parents in settlement creates an inherent conflict. In addition, Your Honor, I think that there were other factors in this case which gave concern to the court that warranted the appointment of a guardian ad litem. And I think that as Texas law has clearly realized that a minor is a ward of the court and that jealous care must be taken to protect the interest of the minor, in this case, my appointment was unchallenged. I served for 2 years with no objection. It is only on the eve of settlement where my appointment becomes critical. And my position as ad litem is vital in terms of raising questions, which were in fact raised, that I am ousted because of an apparent lack of conflict.
Counsel, you billed for over $1 million. Have you been paid that?
No.
Fees?
No.
Is that part of this controversy?
No, not at all. In fact, it's a red herring issue. As the court will see, in the order removing me as ad litem, the very last point indicates that the court had not even addressed the reasonableness or necessity of the attorney ad litem fee.
So this is not motivated in your part to continue to bill as you have been for the past 2 years?
No. And in fact, as the court would see, I've even offered to answer questions to participate in this case because I believe that my issue, the issue of responsibility of a lawyer is separate and apart from the issue of fees. The fees are my interest.
And
I protect the child's interest.
In this proceeding, are you challenging the very person who will ultimately set your fee?
That's right.
Now, with reference to the question of whether there is a conflict between the parents and the children, one of the concerns that I have is whether or not we have a sufficient record before us to ascertain that. Would you respond on that aspect of this proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. The court reporter in the 151st, Ms. Jackie Miles, suffered a personal tragedy when her daughter was shot in a robbery attempt. As a result, I was only able to secure the transcript yesterday. It will be filed this morning with the clerk's office.
Is it your contention that, and we have one order, I don't know whether it's from you or someone or your opponent here from the court, I believe there is another order attached to your original petition, that order shows a conflict on its face?
No, and in fact, even if we assume that the record supports the findings in the order, it's my position that once a guardian ad litem is appointed to protect the children, then the test for removal, once that relationship is created, needs to be whether or not the removal is in the best interest of the child.
Who makes that call?
The judge would make that call, Your Honor.
And she did?
No, Your Honor. She made a determination that there was no conflict. She used the improper test in removing the guardian ad litem. She never addressed or developed a record as to whether or not my removal was in the best interest of the children. Now, if this court would remand this for a factual determination as to whether or not it was, in fact, not in the best interest of the children for me to continue serving, that would be a separate matter, and I probably could not have attacked that on mandamus. She used the improper test of whether or not there was a present conflict, rather than, as this court is aware in the Irvish case, to the substitution or removal of an ex-friend. The test is whether or not it's in the child's best interest.
Counsel, let me understand the exact sequence of events here. The suit was filed involving a lot of parents, a lot of children. The parents' claims were settled. It was not until after settlement of the parents' claims that the trial court, Judge Trevathan, sitting at that time, appointed, discerned some parent conflict and appointed you as guardian ad litem. Is that correct? There was an ad litem
right up
to the point that the parents' claims were settled. Then that ad litem stepped out. Subsequently, Judge Trevathan appointed you ad litem because she detected that there were apparently continuing conflicts.
Right. I would assume so, Your Honor. I mean, that is exactly what happened. And as Judge Garcia's order of removal states, there was no challenge to my appointment, and she's presuming the appointment was correct when made. Also, under the case law, we would assume this court found sufficient facts warranting a conflict necessitating the appointment.
You're trying, I see that green light blink.
I guess
that means on to your cohort, but you're seeking mandamus on three separate things then, and the first of these, which you've limited your argument to, is to mandamus Judge Garcia with reference to the ad litem appointment to do exactly what?
To reinstate me as ad litem. I've considered this at some length. And I understand the reluctance of this court to require that a judge have a court-appointed lawyer for children that there is now some conflict with, and I'm concerned about the mandamus action. However, I'm also concerned that unless I'm reinstated, if this court even lifts the gag order or rules on the sealing issue as to whether or not the records were sealed, the immediate thing when the court is revested with power will be to approve these settlements without sufficient communication.
Surely you're not saying that you want Judge Garcia mandamus to reinstate you personally. Your concern is for the best interest of the children and that this conflict between the interests of the parties be duly dealt with.
As far as whether or not she utilized the proper test for removing me personally, I think that she did not, and technically I should be entitled to reinstatement as the attorney ad litem.
For how long?
Until such time it is determined that the best interest of the children would be better served.
Well, part of the services you hope to render were for monitoring the medical monitoring of these children over the next 30 years, I believe. Would it be your position that insofar as that medical treatment continue over the next 30 years, that you have a right to stay on as ad litem?
Frankly, Your Honor, I'm not an administrative lawyer in a general sense. I'm a trial lawyer, and I'm also an advocate. That, I assumed, would be handled by someone else, perhaps with a business firm, and in fact, the court would look at my letter attached to my bill. What I stated in there is that the defendant should hold those funds to benefit whomever the court may appoint as a future ad litem to make sure that the monitoring fund or the monitoring program was conducted in accordance with the settlement agreement.
Well, how long are you personally entitled to stay on as ad litem?
I would assume until it's not in the best interest of the children for me to do so.
And the trial judge determines that, and as long as you disagree, then you're entitled to stay on, and that because that amounts to an abuse of discretion.
No.
Is that your argument?
The fact that she would make a determination under the proper test that it is not in the children's best interest, I mean, we would have to have a record. We would have to show. In this case, once this court looks at the record and they see that at the mediation, the parents were told something completely different than these annuities, or, as I've stated, the children were not rated, and I don't know if any of you understand the concept of rating or how it can dramatically affect the cost of annuities, but this could be a million-dollar fraud.
Well, and if I understand what you're saying, it means that the answer to Judge Carnes' question is yes, but let me ask again in a slightly different way. Is it your position that the trial judge, once you were reinstated, could dismiss you at any time after a determination is made with a full record and hearing and a finding that it is no longer in the best interest of the children to have you as ad litem?
Absolutely.
And so you're really just asking us to put you back into the ad litem position until such time as that determination on a full record is made with such right for, I guess, appeal or further mandamus action as might be appropriate after that decision's made, if it's made.
Absolutely. I mean, that may be painful for me to go through, but I would at least have the opportunity to present the facts which would warrant the retention of an ad litem or possibly me personally. Frankly, Justice Doggett, I don't think many people would have gone through what I have gone through in order to ensure these children's interests are protected. And to that extent, I'm glad I'm the one standing here, because there were many times that I felt like not going through this was not a fun experience. But I had taken an oath to the children, and I found repeatedly evidence, for example, of commercial bribery, where the judge said she was going to refer it to the district attorney's office on these annuities, of facts that would show that they were including in a monitoring fund gynecological exams for male children for 119 male children. And it was only after my insistence that they disavowed any interest in the reversionary interest in that trust and allowed it to go to the children. It was through my efforts that I have examined the tax consequences. If the court looks at these settlement letters, you can see that there are horrendous constructive receipt problems which have been generated by counsel in this case. People who have not considered the long-term ramifications of the children, but only the short-term personal gain. There has to be somebody there who says, damn to y'all, my interest is to the children. I took an oath to protect the children, and that is what I took an oath to do.
And that can be done by no other ad litem other than Valerie Davenport.
Absolutely, it might be able to, and I would hope that the judge who would appoint the next ad litem, and there are many wonderful ad litem. I know that this court is aware that there have been some abuses with ad litem. However, there are many people of the character sufficient to protect the interests of helpless children.
Were there
the court
any
needs to find someone.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
No.
Were there any actuaries or tax experts hired?
Yes, Your Honor. I hired the only tax expert in the case to evaluate the settlement at Deloitte & Touche, Mr. Chris Parsons. I was the only one who did that. I was the only one who examined the effect of the monitoring program under the tax provision for the designated settlement fund on behalf of these miners. I was repeatedly told by the plaintiff's lawyers that they had no tax knowledge and did not know or understand these things. So I did it.
Ms. Davenport, I see another green light, and I'm
yes.
not sure what
I,
it means, but
I know,
I'm
going
to be sure we get the points 2 and 3.
Okay. Yes. In conclusion, Your Honors, the other thing that I would like to point out is in the order, the protective order, you will notice on the very first sentence, it recognizes a conflict between the counsel and the parents. It does not include me there. So in one order one day, she recognizes the conflict. The next day, in entering a separate order, she states there is no conflict. I think the proper test is what's in the best interest of the kids. And if I'm removed because it's in the best interest, then I'm quiet. If it's not in the best interest, I'll be here again.
How much time do we have left, Counsel?
4 minutes.
4 minutes.
May it please the court, the gag order is before each of you. It was handed up at the beginning of the argument. It's important to look at precisely what the court did here. The court, when faced with the factual situation before it, made a determination that there was a conflict and that the conflict had caused miscommunications. The response of the court was to resolve the conflict issue by finding no conflict and therefore discharging the guardian ad litem, not making a determination that this guardian ad litem should be discharged and one substituted, but that the guardianship itself should be terminated. The second determination made by the court was that the miscommunications issue could be resolved by a near total ban on communications. At a September 21st town meeting, well after the mandamus petitions in this case were filed, all of the plaintiffs were brought before the court to discuss the issue of settlement. At that meeting, the judge stated, and this transcript will be filed with the court after this proceeding, that the media does not generally present accurate information, that it does not present the full facts, and often causes bias and prejudice. And she admonished those in the courtroom that this, the courtroom, is the only place you should be getting information. The gag order itself goes far beyond any of the well-established principles established by this court under Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution and the First Amendment and the decisions of the United States Supreme Court implementing it.
On what basis could such an order have been entered?
A narrowly drawn order that was designed to protect a substantial governmental interest that was not directly related to the suppression of speech.
Specifically, in this case, what?
Oh, in this case, I think that the judge could have entered an order that would have gone to an evil that she perceived. Your Honor, I'm not quite sure what it was. Miscommunication is a very vague term. If the judge was concerned that there were falsehoods being communicated by counsel to the plaintiff's class that was upsetting the judicial process, the remedy should not have been a gag order. The remedy should have been more speech. The remedy should have been admonishments about further falsehoods. And the remedy should have been the determination of what was false and what was true. There is a case out of the Fifth Circuit that I think is dispositive of the issues before this
if
court.
If this were an ordinary lawyer in case and not an ad litem who was misrepresenting the proceedings to his client, could the judge enjoin that?
Your Honor, the question is what the judge would do about it. The judge would have a disciplinary process of the court, or the judge would have contempt power. The judge would have a panoply of sanctions to deal with delicate intervention into the attorney-client relationship based upon determinations of truth or falsehood, a difficult thing for a sitting judge to do in the course of an ongoing proceeding. And what the First Amendment teaches us and what the Texas Constitution says with even more force is you let the speaker speak at his or her peril.
Well,
then come back and solve the problem later.
That's why it's difficult for me to understand how, if a lawyer is misrepresenting the proceedings to his client, the judge should say, no, sir, you tell him the truth now. You tell him this is what's happening. How can the judge do that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm suggesting that only under the narrowest of circumstances, such as an attorney who argues perjured testimony before a court. In that circumstance, there may be a clear and present danger to to the ongoing judicial proceeding that would warrant precise factual findings by the court of an ongoing imminent danger to the conduct of a fair judicial proceeding, interference with perhaps Sixth Amendment rights in a criminal case.
Well, this is not a criminal case.
It is not, Your Honor. And I think the state interest...
Isn't it preferable to deal with even extremely abusive conduct of the type you have limited your answer to by methods other than by gagging and destroying someone's First Amendment rights?
Clearly, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has established a number of very clear working principles that are to determine the kinds of remedies that a court should utilize in these very delicate interfaces between First Amendment rights and substantial governmental interests. The substantial governmental interest, which I hasten to add, was not identified here. Those working principles are that, first, there is a heavy presumption against the constitutionality of prior restraints. And this was unquestionably a prior restraint. The broadly framed bans on speech, whether legislative or judicial, are constitutionally suspect. The language of the order before you has as its hallmark its breadth. There is no attempt to limit it temporally, to limit it by subject matter, to limit it by means of dissemination.
Are you asserting, you made reference to the Texas Constitution earlier, are you asserting free speech rights under the Texas Constitution as well as the United States Constitution?
That's correct, Your Honor. I read Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution as going beyond the First Amendment.
Have you briefed that and cited us any authority on the broader protections afforded by the Texas Constitution?
No, we haven't, Your Honor. I entered this case after the briefing was terminated.
Are you interested in filing any supplemental briefing on that issue?
We would welcome the opportunity to file supplemental briefing with this court on the First Amendment issues.
And what is the Fifth Circuit case you began to tell us about?
Yes, Your Honor. In Bernard versus Gulf Oil Company, 619 Fed Second 459, an en banc determination by the Supreme Court in 1980 that was subsequently affirmed in the 9-0 decision by the United States Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit was faced with a set of facts where there had been conciliation of a race discrimination claim. The conciliation provided for opting in or opting out by class members to financial and other remedies. A group of plaintiff's attorneys then came in and filed a separate action and began to try to convince individuals that they should opt out of the conciliation. The trial court entered an order gagging the attorneys from talking to the potential clients, as well as gagging the class members from talking to each other. The Fifth Circuit, in a very well-reasoned opinion, found that that was an unconstitutional prior restraint and discussed at length what would have been less restrictive and more appropriate alternatives for the trial court to have utilized.
With seeing that your time is out, but that there is an important third point, I want to try to focus very narrowly on that third point. And that is, with reference to your contention that there has been an improper sealing of court files without any attempt to comply with the requirements of Rule 76A, how can we consider that matter when the trial judge basically tells us that there's no sealing that has occurred?
Now, Your Honor, I read Rule 76A and the available legislative history and commentary on it as a statement by this court of a dramatic step forward in opening up and ventilating the judicial process. I believe that inherent in that effort was a recognition that the vice of closed proceedings, of sealing orders, might visit with the most vengeance in cases where it was not a formal entry of an order, but rather de facto sealing. Situations where only the most privileged of attorneys would be granted access to a file. Situations where a file would be open to attorneys but closed to the public and the litigants before the court. Those sorts of situations that are ripe for discrimination. What this court has before it is a factual record that establishes that at least as to some parties, this file was sealed. That is enough, I believe, for this court to determine that the court erred in failing to comply with the procedures of 76A.
That evidence consists of affidavits. There's no written or oral record on a transcript that seals this file. Is that true?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that's a situation that will recur and be back before this court. What do we do about a judge who enters a de facto sealing order? There is never going to be a formal record. Now, this court may determine that the best remedy would be a remand for development of a further factual record. But you have enough difficult questions before you in this case. The fact of the matter is that both sides agree that as of today, the file is open. I think the more important question is, what happened while it may have been closed? What happened while the gag order was operating? What happened was the most critical event in the course of this litigation, the consideration by the plaintiffs of the finality of the settlement. We believe that you must reverse the gag order. We believe that you must reverse and grant mandamus on the ad litem appointment. But we believe that you must go further. And the extra step that you must take is to open this process, to do what the Supreme Court has recognized time and time again, that speech is the remedy, not the vice, that the public is capable of making wise decisions if they have more information. This case should be remanded.
I think you've also already answered the question.
You're
left in office at a considerable time. Any further questions from the court? We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, respondents will be represented by Tom Pettit and B. Lee Ware. Mr. Pettit will proceed first.
May it please the court, Judge Garcia. I'm going to address two aspects of this proceeding, and Mr. Ware is going to address the First Amendment aspect of this proceeding. In view of the last comment, I think it's important that the court get somewhat of a factual background of this case to understand how it has proceeded through its various stages. In 1984, I had the opportunity and the privilege to file a lawsuit on behalf of some adults and ultimately 213 children concerning exposure to chemicals at what is called the Brio site, and had sued several defendants, but the primary defendant remaining in this case is Farm and Home Savings Association, which is represented by Mr. Ware. In 1987, I had the opportunity to, after 6 weeks of trial, to settle the adults' claims for approximately $20 million. In that settlement, we settled all claims that the adults might have for future medical expenses of their children. Subsequent to that, I have pursued the case up until as of today, but through the process of mediation, which was done on July of 1991. At that time, through these various affidavits that you've heard, there's been some argument as to what the status of the settlement was. We had a number of what I called and I referred to as the more articulate and vehement members of the class of individuals we represented at the mediation. We obtained a written document which is attached to the record showing what the settlement agreement proposal was. There has been an argument that has somehow been breached, that there was a treatment plan contemplated versus a medical treatment plan, versus a medical monitoring plan. I think that is, in fact, a rabbit trail. What is important for the court to understand is that after letters were written to the clients offering them what the defendants offered in settlement, which was two phases. One, cash. The other, an annuity, and in both of these offers was inclusive of a medical monitoring plan. That was communicated to the client. There was a September 21st, 1991 hearing in which the judge presided, where she also, and in front of the defendants, recapped what the offer was. And to date, 205 out of the 208 remaining clients that we have in this proceeding have opted for one of the two proposals to them.
Counsel, was the ad litem permitted to participate in that September 21st meeting?
She had been terminated prior to that meeting.
So
she was not there. There was not an ad litem.
Are there circumstances in which an ad litem should not be terminated?
Well, that begs the question. First, they have to have a reason for being appointed.
Having
if there are a reason to be appointed, I would assume there's reason to keep them on. And there are reasons to terminate them if they're not acting in the best interest of the child, of the children.
And those are? If they're not acting in the best
interest? Perhaps, you know, I could pick a myriad of them. The theft of the child, lying to the children. I mean, any of a myriad of things that is not protecting the child's interest.
Well, do you agree with Ms. Davenport, then, that to remove an ad litem in any kind of case, that the court must make a determination that it's no longer in the best interest of the person whose interest the ad litem was appointed to
that? I think that there should be some type of basis for the court's opinion. And that's something that's been left out of this proceeding, or at least I didn't glean from Ms. Davenport's argument. What the court needs to be informed of, I believe it was 8 days, seven or eight days, complete days of hearings were conducted concerning the ad litem.
The question to you, though,
please,
counsel, is...
I'm sorry?
The question to you, please, is the test for removal the best interest of the child?
If the appointment was proper, yes.
Was that the basis of this order?
Yes.
Where does it say that?
I believe it's in, I don't have the order before me.
But there's nothing in it about the best interest of the child, is there?
Well, she had made a finding, and I assume it's an implicit finding, it's not an express finding.
There's nothing on in the order that says anything about the best interest of the child, is it?
No, not specifically in that regard.
And you agree that that's the test?
That's correct.
So isn't the order deficient in that regard?
I don't believe so, because I had the opportunity to go through 8 days of hearings where the court made various findings and heard from a myriad of witnesses.
Counsel, apparently when Judge Trevathan appointed Ms. Davenport as ad litem, she discerned some conflict between the parents and the children. Or the parents' attorneys and the children. Or the attorneys and the parents and the children. I don't know. So she felt it was necessary to appoint an ad litem. This is after the parent settlements, after the termination of the previous ad litem. Apparently, from her perspective, some conflicts had arisen or manifested themselves to the extent that an ad litem was necessary to protect the best interest of the children. And then, I don't recall which, I presume this is the second order here, or the first order, I'm not sure.
There's a September 10th and a September 11th order.
Okay, this is,
pardon? That's September 10th. And September
right, this
11th.
Is a September the 11th order. Protective order said, upon hearing evidence that conflicts between counsel and parents of the minor children resulted miscommunications, etc. And then, apparently only, was it the September 10th order that the ad litem was terminated because no conflicts existed? And then there's patent inconsistency here. Can you address that?
No, Your Honor, I can't because I can't speak to the judge.
Conflicts exist and don't exist all simultaneously.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that. I don't believe there was ever a conflict. I don't know why Judge Trevathan appointed this ad litem. That was done sua sponte. You have the ad litem complaining about lack of a hearing for her dismissal, but I was not afforded the opportunity to be there and argue whether we needed an ad litem when she was appointed.
And that court's responsibility, though.
And the court's responsibility. As we go through, as I indicated, approximately 99% have accepted the options that were presented to them. Those are the only two options. There was never a medical treatment plan offered. That was something that was written by the ad litem to the clients, actually without the attorney of record's knowledge. We did not receive a copy of this correspondence from the ad litem to these clients until some later period, months later. That is where the treatment notion came. I suspect that the treatment, due to its financial nature, future financial nature to the ad litem, may have had some motivation in that regard, I personally find a $1,200,000 ad litem fee repugnant, but we're not here to address that. We're here to address that at a later
point.
Then
why bring it up?
There is some indication in the materials about the time-sensitive nature of this case. What is the effect of delay?
The effect of delay, Your Honor, and I'll let the defendant speak to that, my co-counsel in this regard, because he's the one that's made the offer. Obviously, in a interest rate time, the interest rates are declining, which we all know they are. The annuity stream benefit available to the children in the future likewise declines. There's only been three or four of these parents that have opted for a cash distribution of funds into a 146 type trust. So the vast majority, 90-something percent of them, are opting for the annuity. Every day that elapses with the reduced interest rate is something that is a lesser income stream to the children. Now, address the 76A argument. There's something that I think is important for the court to recognize, and I pointed it out in my brief, but I'd want to bring it forward one more time, and that is the fact that this judge, if she complains under 76A of a order sealing the records, which is non-existent, a de facto order, that the least Judge Garcia should have been afforded was the opportunity of a motion as required by 76A before we even get to this point to determine if there was any type of sealing so that she can rectify that situation. It would appear to me from the affidavits that had been filed that if any alleged sealing occurred, it was surely not by Judge Garcia, subject of this motion. It was, in fact, if it was, in fact, by some clerk, that would be the subject of a writ of mandamus, not this judge. She has undeniably and unequivocally told this court that she has not and did not seal any records.
There's an affidavit filed by Attorney Joe Jamail that says he was never denied access. Is there?
That is correct. And there's also an affidavit by the court reporter that she relies on so heavily, saying that no attorney or client was denied access to this file.
But there is also an affidavit of Cheryl Finley that she was.
Yes, right? That is. That's correct.
And in a circumstance where parties cannot get access to the file according to their sworn affidavits, you say that the appropriate remedy is not mandamus, but for a motion, what, to reconsider or modify the alleged sealing order directed to the trial judge?
My understanding of what Rule 76A says, that in order to avail yourself of the appellate procedure, or the appellate remedies under 76A, is that you first must file a motion pointing that out to the court.
With reference to the first issue that you have addressed on the appointment of the ad litem, original petition for writ of mandamus back on September 20th alleged on page 3 that because the children's settlement package now proposed allocate settlement funds to provide annual medical exams for the children for a 30-year period, including the years until their majority, there was and exists an inherent conflict. I have two questions about that. Number one, is it accurate with reference to what the children's settlement package now proposed does?
What they have proposed to them is a monitoring plan that, if not utilized and if not used by the children, the $3.6 million funding fee will be returned to the children in cash pro rata.
Okay, well then, is the answer that it is accurate or it is inaccurate to say that the children's settlement package now proposed allocate settlement funds to provide annual medical exams for the children for a 30-year period, including the years until majority?
That is correct.
Okay. And
if utilized by the children.
And why is that not, as urged by the petition,
why does that not involve an inherent conflict?
Well, my belief in that regard, and you'll have to talk to Mr. Ware as to what the agreement is subsequent to me sitting down, but that is an absolute among every one of the remaining 700 cases. That is an absolute, in my understanding, to almost the extent of an interplead of that money into the registry of the court on all these cases, regardless of the outcome of the proceeding.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time do you have left, Mark?
10 minutes.
How much?
10 minutes.
10 minutes.
And they have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
And that's extra above and beyond.
May it please the court. I'm Lee Ware. I'm counsel for the respondent, real party in interest, that is Farm and Home Savings Association. Russell Serafin is with me. He also represents Farm and Home. Farm and Home is a Missouri corporation. It's the same company that has an office right outside the window over there. Let me begin by talking about, if I may, with the court, the guardian ad litem. I do not know of the authority that constitutes the test in this state that the removal of the guardian ad litem is different than the appointment of the guardian ad litem. If it is the position of this court that once there is an ad litem, a lawyer appointed for purposes of litigation, and that is then the court's position to never remove that person until there's a fact finding that it's in the best interest of the guardian of the children to remove it, that's news to me. Because that in effect means that parents are being displaced from making decisions about their children. And I know of no such authority, and to the extent that Mr. Pettit has his view on that, I very definitely have a different view on that. I do not think it is the office of this court or Judge Garcia, absent a conflict, to say that the judgment of Ms. Davenport or some other lawyer is superior to your natural born parents or your parents, your natural parents, and therefore I'm not going to listen to your parents, I'm going to listen to this lawyer that I've appointed. And that's wrong. The test for removal is not different from the test of appointment. This case could have rocked along until the very day of settlement without a guardian ad litem ever being appointed. And that often is the case in Harris County, that the ad litem is never appointed until the date of settlement. The reason why Ms. Davenport served for 2 years without comment is because she didn't do anything for 2 years. She sat through 2 to 3 days of mediation when we're hacking out a settlement coming from $150 million, which is their demand, and $3 million, which is our offer, and getting the case settled at $19 million. And part of that is a monitoring fund. And there's never any big to-do and never any big deal made about a treatment fund. And it's only after the fact, when to Ms. Davenport's surprise, the case that she's looked upon to give her a substantial fee is about to disappear, that she begins hiring tax experts, other lawyers, economists, brokers. All of that transpires not during the 2 years of the pendency of the case, but when Ms. Davenport starts to look for the $1.2 million fee. And that's wrong. And this court should not abide by that. Now, I think I've said what I need to say about the attorney ad litem, except for one final thing. The attorney ad litem in a conflict, or if I may, Justice Gamage, the protective order says, upon hearing evidence that conflicts between counsel and the parents of the minor children were resulting in miscommunications. The court is there not talking about conflicts between the parents and the kids. She was, in fact, talking about conflicts between Ms. Davenport and Mr. Pettit and Mr. Aitkins as they came to hate each other during the course of the settlement blow-up. She's talking about conflicts between Mr. Aitkins and Mr. Pettit and their clients. Some of the parents came to dislike them and remove themselves from their representation. And that's the conflict that she's talking about. This was not, sir, an instance in which the judge on one hand is finding a conflict and on the other hand is making the conflict go away. That's just, you know, I don't have any special allegiance to the court or other than the fact that she is the court. But I have to tell you, that's not what she was doing. And if you interpret her that way, you're misinterpreting what she was doing. I'm sorry about that. And that should not be done because that also would be wrong. The treatment fund was never an issue. It was never offered, never would be offered. We couldn't put it in place with MD Anderson. The monitoring fund was there because Joe Jamail, Ronnie Crist, and the other lawyers that have got the other 700 cases said, We're going to have a monitoring fund because we've gone out there and talked about all these terrible chemicals that are in the ground, and the only way we can keep our skirts clean from these miners 18, 20 years from now coming back and suing when they turn up with disease is to have a monitoring fund. So there was no conflict, Justice Doggett, because there was never a decision by the parents to be made. Because Seraph and I said to these gentlemen, you're going to get the monitoring fund because if we don't have a monitoring fund, we can't settle these other 700 cases. So that's not, there's no decision for the parents to be made. No conflict of interest that the parents have can play a part because there's no decision to be made by them, by Ms. Davenport, by the court, or by anybody. It's not subject to debate. The monitoring fund was always going to be in place because that's the only way we could get the case settled, the whole litigation taken care of. And so, consequently, there is no conflict. 76A. And I'll come back to some of these issues, but I want to cover the other two remaining issues where I still have some time. Do I have any time?
5 minutes.
Okay. I want to cover those other two, and then I'll come back with any time I have remaining if there are any questions with regard to the ad litem. 76A is a good rule, and I don't want to take on the burden, and in other cases, I've not wanted to take on the burden of talking about sealing the court files. This is a pretty unexciting court file. It consists of mostly nothing, because there was a settlement put in place, and there was really nothing filed after the settlement. The settlement was back in June, or at least that's where July, that's when we thought we had it settled, and there's nothing going on in the file that's very exciting. But the judge can't file the case, or can't seal the case. The judge didn't seal the case, as far as I know, and she says she didn't seal the case. And if there is a clerk that is refusing a party access to a file, unexciting though it is, then there certainly would be mandamus against the clerk, because the clerk possesses the file, and the clerk ought to be made to cough up the file. But that's the kind of mandamus that can be filed in the trial court. And if you go to Judge Garcia, and you say to her, this clerk won't let me see the file, and I want to mandamus the clerk, and here's my petition, then it is her obligation to deal with that on the basis in which she normally would deal with it. And I would think that probably you would get access to the file. I think that there are exceptions. I think that a judge ought to be able to keep the file, a trial judge ought to be able to keep the file on his or her desk while he or she is working on it. But short of that, I think that 76A is clear. The files are open unless you follow those procedures. I don't see that that's a major issue in this. It's not going to make or break the settlement. It's not going to have anything to do with it. And I think this court ought to render an order that says, we don't, as a factual matter, mandamus doesn't lie because we don't know if the judge did or didn't do it, and it's not a proper subject for mandamus. But it's clear that courts can't seal files, and that can let it be done with it. Free speech, gag order. This is a landmine. I actually had to go read some of these cases, and I have to tell you, that it is a serious matter for a judge, and a very serious matter for a judge, to levy a gag order. And there's a question as to, in the Supreme Court of the United States, as to which way you go. Do you go the balancing test? That is the test that has to do with the legitimate state interest in limiting speech in some way, or limiting conduct in some way to pursue a legitimate state interest. Or do you go the other side of the test, and that has to do with those cases where there is some intent to levy censorship upon content. The gentleman from Washington, D.C. has suggested that you must go in the route in which it is a clear and imminent danger side of the test as opposed to a balancing type test. I submit to you that it should be a balancing test. I submit to you that what Judge Garcia was doing, there was a mediation. And you all know, when there's a mediation, the lawyers are gagged. You can never talk to anybody about anything that happens during the mediation. Now that's the First Amendment. After there was a settlement hacked out, Judge Garcia got into a situation where she began to lose faith that Aikens and Pettit had control of their clients, that there may not be a settlement. She knew she had 200 plaintiffs out there, children, minors, that she has an interest in protecting, regardless of Ms. Davenport, regardless of Mr. Aikens and Mr. Pettit. She got into a series of hearings, and I'll show you, Mr. Serafin's got them over there, and they're that tall, the record you don't have in front of you, about bribery, Ms. Brokers, Ms. Davenport's conduct, and things of that nature. And at the end of all of that, she went ahead and approved the settlement. She then had got communications, I believe, from some of the parents, if they weren't sure what was going on. And what she did was, she brought the lawyers in, and she said, I want you all to stop talking to each other, because they're fighting like cats and dogs. And I want you to not talk to anybody and get any more lawyers involved, because there were already two lawyers that didn't even represent parties that put on evidence in the hearings. And I don't want you talking to Ms. Flecklinger from the press out down in that area, because I want it all frozen until I can get these 200 parents in here with these kids and explain to them what really is on the table, so that there can be an intelligent decision made based upon what the actual offer is as to what's best for these 200 kids.
As laudable as that is, though.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
As laudable as that is.
Yes.
And as genuine as we must assume trial court to be in her intentions, what basis is there for ordering that the parents cannot talk to anybody else about this case except counsel? That precludes them even from talking among themselves.
Yes, sir. It does. The problem was one of rumor amongst a tightly knit group of people as to what was going on. And I think what she saw was the solution in this instance was to preserve the settlement and manage her docket and to freeze it, the proceeding, until such time as she could get them in. It's like a trial that's ongoing, only it's in recess.
And
I think that's the way she viewed it.
When those kind of practical administrative interests conflict with the First Amendment and the provisions for free speech in the Texas Constitution, it's pretty obvious how they need to be resolved, isn't it?
Sir, I think that there is a real strong presumption with respect to free speech, but I think that in terms of the Texas Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, that there are cases and instances in which a judge in the course of a trial can say, I don't want you all talking to the newspapers.
That what occurred in this case, this protective order, is not only unconstitutional, but blatantly unconstitutional, isn't it, from your reading of the cases?
No, sir. It is
can
not.
Can you cite us any case authority that supports the kind of restriction on free speech that occurred in this case?
Shepherd versus Maxwell. That's 384 U.S. 333, 1966. Collaboration between counsel and the press can be stopped.
A civil case?
Yes. No, that's a criminal case.
Can you cite us any civil case in this country where it is appropriate to gag counsel and clients in the fashion that occurred here?
You can narrow it to the point where I can't get there.
Well,
I can cite you cases.
How about all the civil cases in the country?
I can cite you.
I can narrow it to that.
I can cite you civil cases, Your Honor, in which they have upheld that it's a balancing test, like Bates versus State Bar of Arizona, Orlick versus Ohio State Bar Association.
Bates against State Bar, is that one of the advertising cases?
Orlick was soliciting business, was running cases.
Yeah, those are the ones concerning the disciplinary rules. What I want to know is whether in any civil case in this country, there is authority for squelching the free speech rights of counsel and clients in the fashion that it occurred here.
There are state court cases.
Is there any federal authority?
There are state court cases, and you asked me for any case. There
right.
are some, yes.
I gather there's no federal authority.
If there is federal authority, it does not exist at the Supreme Court level.
What is the state
and
court
And I'll have
authority?
To look at the Fed Second and the Fed Subs, and I'll do so for you.
Great. What is the state court authority to rely on?
It's over there in my briefcase, and I'll have to submit that to the court, and we'll do so.
Great.
And I will say, I'm not sure if they arose out of the civil context or criminal context, and I'll have to look at it.
Is it your contention?
There is state court authority that indicates that there are broader abilities for the trial courts to regulate the conduct of lawyers than exist in the federal cases that I just cited to you, Your Honor.
Is it your contention and argument to the court today that based on your reading of these cases, civil or criminal, that the action taken in this case on this particular protective order did not violate the free speech rights of Ms. Davenport or the clients or counsel involved in this case? Is that what you're telling me?
I think that there is an abridgment of the right. I think that on the balancing test it's justified because she's trying to save a settlement for 200 minors that she's got an interest in protecting. She was not saying you can't make a political statement. She was not saying I'm not going to ever let you talk about this. All she was doing was I want it frozen until I can get them in here and make sure they understand what they're making decisions on. It's in the nature of a proceeding, and I think that's a balancing interest. You know, she applied that to all the lawyers.
Was she saying that someone couldn't advise those parents on possible future medical treatment that their children might require, or the tax ramifications of the proposed structure of the settlement, things of that nature? Was she saying that they couldn't communicate among themselves and receive that kind of advice?
No, sir. I think she was talking about, I don't want the lawyers in there making this worse than the situation is in terms of maybe losing the settlement.
But isn't that the effect of her order?
No, sir. I don't think that was the effect of the order. I don't think that there's anything in the order that would indicate that the parents couldn't go seek the advice of a physician or financial advice.
Is there anything in the order suggesting it's limited as to time?
I think that it was always understood by us that it was going to be limited by the time at which Ms. Davenport, when the court made a decision as to whether or not Ms. Davenport was going to continue to be the ad litem, and that was our understanding. There is no written limitation there.
In fact, it still applies to her today.
I don't think it applies to her today, no, sir.
You think she's free to talk?
I think she is free. I'm sorry, I don't mean to step on you, Judge. I'm bothered by the red light.
I understand.
Let your opponent go first,
so I want to make sure you have equal time to respond. But
yes,
you don't believe that it restricts her currently?
No, sir. I think that the only thing that controls her at the present time are whatever strictures there are controlling any other lawyer. I think that Ms. Davenport, in statement of opinion, based upon the hearings and based upon the conduct of trying to deal with this case, I think Ms. Davenport has stumbled upon two facts that are important to her. One is you can run a huge bill for ad litem. And two is, you can use the cloak of the ad litem to run cases for plaintiff's lawyers. That's my opinion.
Counsel.
And that's harsh talk, but that's what I believe.
Well, it is harsh talk. And
I apologize for that.
And as far as the fee is concerned, that's still subject to the trial court's approval. And it may conflict with what you said, that she's demonstrated some willingness to take on the trial court in this matter. But as I read this order of September the 11th, the court abated the appointment of the guardian ad litem until further order of this court, but specifically applied this protective order to the guardian, and that during the abatement, the guardian was to have no contact with plaintiffs. Now, that sounds like a pretty good crimp in communications there.
Yes, sir. I think that her position was, until I'm certain whether or not you're going to be a lawyer in the case, Ms. Davenport, I don't want you talking to these other lawyers' clients. I think that's what she was trying to say. And I think that the normal rules of ethics would preclude her from doing that if she was not a sitting lawyer. Once she was released from her responsibility, I think that she doesn't have any business talking to those plaintiffs. So they're still represented by Mr. Akins and Mr. Pettit, and 205 out of 208 to date have taken so. If we can ever get it done.
That's, of course, based upon the advice of their parents' counsel.
Yes, sir, which is exactly the lot that anybody that goes out and hires a lawyer and puts their affairs in that lawyer's.
I understand, but these aren't the parents' claims you're talking about at this point.
No, sir, they are not the parents' claims. And eventually, she's going to have a say as to whether or not this is the best interest of these kids. And in the end, it's her responsibility, backed up by y'all, as to whether or not she's done the right thing and whether or not it's in the best interest of the kids to take the settlement. And in the end, what my position on 76A and free speech and so forth is, you got a trial judge trying to say a hard mediated settlement, trying to do what's right, and she gets a little bit overbought in the way she writes the order. You ought to interpret the order to make some sense out of it, and they all ought to go up to Washington, D.C. and take their loans with her as opposed to against her.
And forget the First Amendment.
No, sir, I'm not saying that at all.
In this situation, if it's more efficient to abandon free speech concerns, do it.
No, sir, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that when there's a facially neutral order and a justified state interest, you're trying to settle, trying to save a settlement, when it is exactly the types of facts that you see here, where a judge is trying to do the right thing, that there is a balancing test with respect to the First Amendment. If I'm in Matagorda County and I'm being worked over by the judge, and worked over by district attorneys and lawyers, and I can nerve myself up to do it and go out and scream to the press that I'm being worked over, that judge can't gag me, and never can, because I'm making a political statement at that time. And that's a different kind of thing than a facially neutral order where the judge is trying to say, I want you to shut up and freeze this thing until I can get a hold of it.
That's different from an attorney ad litem going out and saying, I think, and it's a question of opinion, and it's a legal opinion, I think in terms of this settlement, we're shafting the kids with possible potential dire consequences. That's within the purview of your gag order.
I think that if there is
an attorney starts getting beat around the head and shoulders, he can run to the newspaper. But an attorney representing some children's interests and perceives, rightly or wrongly, perceives that those children's best interest are not being served can't say anything about it.
No, sir. I think the point that you're making is the right point. If Ms. Davenport is really the attorney ad litem, she's left in the case. I think at some point in time, if she's left in, she gets to go and say to the newspaper or whoever, I'm being worked over by this judge, just like I would if I were down in the country someplace and worked over the local country judge.
But that is time limited, you say, and the time it's limited to is she can do that after the deed is done, the deal is cut, and it's all moved.
No, sir. I think that once she is no longer the ad litem, and that order ceases to have a preclusive effect upon her First Amendment rights, I think she gets to go tell whoever she wants to about it. I think she gets to talk to the newspaper, whoever she wants to. There is no suggestion here, I don't think. And I certainly never interpret the judge as telling me that I'm never going to get to talk to anybody about this case ever.
But facially, at least, this order applied to her once she was terminated.
It applied to me, too. And I'm just saying.
No, but you're still on the case, right?
Yes.
It's all right to do it to the lawyer on the case. You just said that that once she was terminated, the court had no hold over her. The court
right.
could not order her to do anything.
I think
but
that's
the
right.
order on its face says they can.
The order on its face, with respect to Ms. Davenport?
Yeah.
I think that the purpose of that order is to put everything on hold until you get to the town.
You're not responding.
I'm sorry?
You're not responding. Once you said a while ago, once the ad litem has been terminated, it's all over. The court has no authority. Cannot gag a terminated ad litem. But this order purports to do exactly that, to put a gag on someone who no longer is serving as ad litem by this order.
I think the order does, Your Honor, purport to say that since she's not a lawyer, she can't go talk to other people who represent by other lawyers until they get to the town meeting, which is what we call a meeting September 21. I think that was the intent. I don't think that the intent there was to forever hold hostage Ms. Davenport's First Amendment rights. And I understand what you're saying, and I wasn't being responsive, and I apologize for that, but I think that's what the intent was.
Any further questions?
Just where the is Rule 4.02 of the state bar rules implicated here, the ethical constraint on all lawyers not to talk to people who are represented by a lawyer without their consent?
Well,
is that
that is one of the instances, and that's one of the cases, and there are cases on that, the federal cases, and that's one of the instances in which there is a legitimate state interest in regulating a specialized profession like the legal profession. That what subjects me to that kind of rule, and what subjects me during the course of the trial of giving up my rights to go talk to the newspaper, except for the political statement exception, which I was talking to the other side of the bench about. What does that is that you are an officer of the court, and while you're an officer of the court, she gets to regulate, and y'all get to regulate certain things.
But as I read
Justice Gamage gets to make me stand here and admit that I've screwed up, and then he gets to make me answer the question.
As I read Rule 4.02, though, it does apply to all lawyers and not just lawyers who are on the case. In other words, Ms. Davenport, once she was dismissed as guardian ad litem, I assume was a legal stranger to the proceeding, but she still was a lawyer and constrained by the ethical constraints.
And still subject to that rule. Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. 5 minutes.
We've come here today with a keen appreciation of the burden that an original proceeding mandamus action places on this court. And aware of that, we believe that scrupulous accuracy of what happened below, allegiance to the record, is imperative given the difficult task before this court. I have here, and I will file it with the court, a certified copy of an order of the 151st Judicial District order in Harris County, court in Harris County, entered on the 22nd day of February 1990, appointing Valerie Davenport as the guardian ad litem. And that order is signed by Tom Pettit, and it says above it, approve an entry requested by. This is the proceeding that Mr. Pettit stood before this court and said he had no opportunity to state his position in. Mr. Ware would provide this court a rewrite of what happened below. First Amendment jurisprudence teaches this court that the language of the order in a First Amendment context is what must bind. If it does not, then any vagueness, any indication of what the judge really meant, any attorney who must function at her peril determining what that order meant is totally unacceptable. The United States Supreme Court in the Virginia pharmacy case was faced with a rule of the Virginia State Legislature that would limit the ability of consumers to have access to information about drug pricing.
Counsel, let me just interrupt you briefly to ask you, if the judge had drawn a narrow order imposing upon Ms. Davenport that obligation which was already imposed upon her under Rule 4.02 of the State Bar Disciplinary Rules, that is, a lawyer should not communicate with a person they know is already represented by a lawyer, would that have been, if it was drawn that narrowly, would that have been sustainable in your view?
Possibly, Your Honor, but I think not. First of all, the Supreme Court last term in Gentile versus State Bar Nevada, a case that I had the good fortune of representing the petitioner in, resolved the issue of conflicts between disciplinary rules and First Amendment rights and determined that disciplinary rules must give way to First Amendment rights because lawyers do not forfeit their speech rights at the courthouse door. Rather, those rules must be measured under analysis of whether or not they serve a substantial governmental purpose and are necessary to further that purpose. Rule 4.02, I believe on its face, provides an exception for a second opinion, contact with another lawyer instituted by the client. To the extent that Ms. Davenport has been contacted, as she has, by members of the class who want to discuss this matter with her, I believe that 4.02 does not bar her. In addition, I think this court, if it were going to address that issue, would have to look at the unique status of a guardian ad litem and the continuing obligation of an attorney who has previously represented a client to continue to provide advice to that attorney about, to that client about the past representation. I was about to discuss Virginia Pharmacy. In Virginia Pharmacy, the Supreme Court, faced with that set of circumstances, said that there was an alternative to what it quoted as the highly paternalistic approach of the Virginia State Legislature, and that alternative was to recognize that information itself is not harmful, and that, quote, people will perceive their own best interests if only they are well enough informed. What this case is about is whether or not the plaintiffs are well enough informed, and what this court must grapple with is the public perception of what went on here. Timing is important. The guardian ad litem was dismissed in an oral order the same day that the gag order was entered. The two written orders of the court followed within one day of each other, confirming the gag order and the dismissal of the guardian ad litem. This was at a time when there was press interest, and the press was reporting that there were questions about the nature of the settlement. The order itself cites conflict without specifying what the conflict is, but clearly cites miscommunications. That all argues for more speech. What can the public perception be of the judicial process if they find that the remedy to that situation is dismissal of the greasing of the wheel that hasn't been greased, the guardian ad litem, the one person who is raising objections to the settlement? What is the public perception to be if the remedy is to silence speech and to say that there can be no public discussion of this matter of public health? The Brio toxic waste problem is one that goes well beyond these plaintiffs. It is of intense public interest in the Houston area. Timing that the other side would tell this court argues for affirmance is the best indicator that we have here that the overall purpose of these orders was to make sure that the settlement occurred. I thank the court for its indulgence in extending us additional time for argument, and we would be pleased to accept Judge Doggett's invitation to submit additional briefing if the court so orders.
Well, we don't have to order it, and this is a case that has been characterized by more hot words than hard authority on either side. I appreciated Mr. Ware's indication that he was going to file some supplemental authority, and if you wish to file it, just please do so promptly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This concludes the work of the court this morning. The three cases argued this morning are submitted based on the brief oral argument. The marshal will adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise.
Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.